It's time to become a member of Playvolution HQ and Explorations Early Learning. There's a free option and three paid patron level options. All come with free stuff and ongoing automatic training and merch discounts. For as little as a dollar a month, you can become a patron. That supports our work and you get premium stuff like early access to fresh podcast episodes. Go to explorationsearlylearning.com/membership or click the link in this episode's description to learn more. All the cool listeners are doing it. On with the show. Wilds of California. We've got Rebecca from the snowy wilds of Illinois. We've got Rachel. How you both doing?
I'm fantastic.
I'm good.
How much snow did you get last night, Rachel?
Not a ton, just enough to like lightly dust the ground.
Oh, so you don't have to go out and get the snow blower out or anything.
Oh no.
Well, that's good. We're going to get into some talk about sensory play and social-emotional development. I think it'll be a fun conversation, but I've got to finish up a story I teased in the last episode when I was talking to Brett. I teased at the beginning of the episode, and we just didn't have time to finish it at the end of the episode. So walking along the beach yesterday, I found a dead body. I called the authorities. They sent out a investigative team. And the only part of the story I left out is it was a sea turtle, not like a human or anything. But it was for me, it was equally sad. And for the turtle and dolphin lady who came to investigate, I think it was probably sadder for her than if it had been. Maybe, you know, she might care about humans too, but I think she was really into turtles and dolphins. Like it had like an 18-inch shell, and it was just laying there at the high tide mark where the surf had left it the night before. And I thought it was, its tongue wasn't sticking out, so I wasn't quite sure it was dead, but it was pretty obviously after looking at it a minute, it was dead. I wanted to haul it home and make soup and a Ninja Turtle, like a Donatello costume for one of my dogs for Halloween, but I didn't think that was right. So I didn't know who's your first call when you find something dead on the beach. I know there are certain things on the beach that people care about, like dead blue crab on the beach, nobody really cares. Dead fish on the beach, not such a big thing. Dead dolphin, whale, or turtle on the beach, somebody cares. But I didn't know who, so I did a little bit of searching and I couldn't find. So I called the local non-emergency police number. And this is like 6:15 in the morning. The sun is not up yet, but it's light out, but early. And the dude is like, yeah, let me get you a number. And he pauses. I hear paper rustling and everything. And he gives me the number. And I'm like, dude, could you tell who might I be calling? And he's like, I don't know. It says it's dolphin and turtles is what it says on my list. So I didn't know if it was just like some rando who was really into dead dolphins and turtles, and then we could be friends or something. But
there's no official title of this person.
No. And so I ended up calling and it rang forever. And then I got, it clicks and then it's an answering service and it's a very perky, very, very perky person at 6:30 in the morning. And I had to try to give her like the location. But I didn't have easily, I added an app now so I can easily have GPS for the next location next time I find a dead thing on the beach. And so we got her oriented, and then Tasha, my wife, was out on the beach later when the CSI turtles person was there, so got all taken care of. So that's the anticlimactic end of that story, listeners.
Well, you know what? That's actually really interesting, Jeff, because I was in Mexico last week,
and you killed a turtle.
I released a baby turtle into the ocean.
Oh, how big was it?
It, oh my gosh, they're so small. I mean, it could, the whole thing fit in the palm of my hand.
So,
there's,
you think it was the same turtle?
There are, hopefully not, and probably not because it's very little. But there's conservation camps there, and you can like pay to be a part of the experience. So there's so many poachers and various reasons why they have to protect the eggs when they get laid.
Sure.
So if you see a turtle laying eggs or like having some activity on the beach, you're supposed to call as well, because then the conservation people come out and they collect the eggs and they basically rebury them in protected nests at the conservation camps. And it's really cool that they wait a certain amount of days. They pay attention to when they're supposed to be hatching. And when they start hatching, they save them just for like a few hours if they can. If they have them at night, if they hatch at night, they let them go immediately. But if they hatch during the day, then you can pay to, they just put it in a little coconut shell for you. You can't touch the turtles because they have salmonella. And you can also get them sick with your germs. So you're not supposed to touch them. But yeah, they give you a little
tiny, who knows what you have.
Tiny baby turtle in a coconut shell. And yeah, you go at sunset and you release the turtle, and it takes a while for them to like crawl their little way into the beach. And what's funny is like, you think it's going to be this like beautiful moment. Here's this turtle going into the ocean, but really it's these waves are lapping up on them and they're like flipping over. It's kind of like traumatic for me. And I had named mine. They're like, give it a name. And so I named mine after my grandmother, my late grandmother. So I'm like, come on, Loretta, stop flipping over.
Do you don't even get to write their name on them with a Sharpie?
You know, no.
That would be, no, what does, either. how many pesos does it cost to release a turtle?
It costs probably, I want to say 900 pesos, like 50 bucks.
Oh, that's not bad for releasing a turtle. That supports the turtles. Yeah, not a lot of turtle activity on our stretch of beach. They had somebody laid eggs like last fall, and it was like in the crappy little, I mean, the sweet little local newspaper. And so the turtle to be any place on our beach is kind of rare because they disappeared years ago.
Because, so you know, they come back to the same beach to lay their mm-hmm. eggs, the babies that are born there. So that's exciting because it could be the start of you know, more turtle activity there. But only 1 in 1,000 babies live to adulthood. So,
And then some of them get murdered, like mine.
Do you get to like follow up with that? Like, what happened to this turtle? Do you have like a tag?
I've got the number in my phone now for the next dead thing I find. But I suppose I could call and ask. But I don't think I'll probably do that.
Well, you know, because it could be like, oh, it was pollution, or it had like, you know, there's so many various reasons why a turtle could wash up. I'm just so curious now.
I think it was probably murder. There was like a 30-foot whale a couple months ago, but I didn't get to find that. So I'm wanting to find more dead stuff. Listeners, that's Turtle Talk. If you got anything to contribute to Turtle Talk, call 228-363-6737 or send a text message. If you call, got to keep that message to around 5 minutes because the voicemail will cut you off. Otherwise you'll keep talking and then you'll get frustrated and then you'll call back to fill out the, anyway, around 5 minutes is the talk time. What are we talking about? We're going to talk about some early childhood stuff, not just turtles. What are we talking about?
We're talking about proprioceptive sensory, I believe, and sensory play in general, but kind of a focus on proprioceptive sensory and that I feel like it's like the forgotten of the senses, right? When we talk about our senses with children. So.
Well, yeah. And I was recording earlier episodes that have probably already released, but talking to Brett earlier, and the interoceptive sensory system is a big one, too. We were talking about how when you're two or three, you get those feelings in what I've decided to call your belly button area, like that 6 or 8 inch circle around your belly button? And does it mean I'm anxious and nervous? Does it mean I need to pee? Does it mean I need to poop? Does it mean I'm getting sick? All kinds of feelings can go down there from the sensory systems that are inside your body, from your organs and your muscles and your nervous system. And a big part of the early years is learning to decipher and differentiate between those signals, because I'm guessing, you know, the three of us, you can both probably tell the difference between feeling nervous or anxious and needing to poop. I mean, by the time right. you grew up, you got that sorted out most of us, most of the time, but when you're 2 and 3 and 4, and even sometimes 6 and 7 and maybe 8, it can be a kind of a confusing thing. And so early learning is about wiring those 8 sensory systems.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring that other, what is it, interoceptive, right?
Interoceptive, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point, because I, you know, I'm working with a family right now, and their child, when she gets upset, she's saying she's tired. And so I think she's kind of trying to figure out that feeling of like, oh, I need comfort, right? Or my body's wanting to shut down a little bit or move away from this situation. And so they're like thinking that she's really tired, and I'm having to explain that, you know, she's almost 3. She's at that age where she's listening to her body cues and that isn't quite sure exactly what word to put on it. But sometimes those feelings, like you say, they do overlap, right? There's something going on in my tummy. What does that mean? You know, I really want to shy away from this situation. There's many reasons I might want to feel that way. Why do I feel that way? And it's hard to think of that. It's hard to think of these experiences as a young child from an adult perspective, because it, like you said, it comes so quickly to us. And yeah. So I think it's important to slow down and remember that it's all so very new to young children.
I have really been jumping into sensory play, because I feel like since post-COVID, right, I'm seeing a lot of, I almost want to say like sensory deprivation with different kids in the age groups that I'm working with. It's like they've kind of missed out on certain experiences for those natural connections to occur. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
totally.
So now it's like I'm playing catch up of how can I help them. Like you said, the interoceptive. I started researching because I feel like some of that play is so natural we don't even realize, and we get into the same like activities that we do with the kids. So I started reading Play to Progress by Allie Ticton. Have either of you read that yet?
No, I haven't.
It's a really easy read, but she starts breaking down basically each of the senses. And like you said, I feel like vestibular, the proprioceptive, and the interoceptive are ones that we just don't necessarily like realize are sensories that we need to work, you know, incorporate when we're teaching early childhood.
Right. Like at least acknowledge it, right? And have an eye out to make sure we're providing those experiences, right? That sensory is, it's not just in a bin. It's not right. just in a sensory table, which I think we can get really pigeonholed in the classroom, that like sensory is just like Play-Doh or Oobleck or whatever, which is great. That's fantastic stuff. But it's so much more than that, right? Like our bodies are so complex, and all of those sensory inputs and outputs, it's all connected to the way that we process information, right? And so it's like all of this sensory is not just to feel good, not just because it feels cool and we're learning about how things feel or how things smell. It's really making sense of everything that we're learning as human beings, that it is really what makes things, I feel like the whole child learning, right? When you can touch and feel and smell and have an interaction with a material or an experience in general, the wind, right? And so I think it's important that we, as educators, really focus on providing a multitude of experiences and acknowledging the importance of all of them, that it's not one thing is better or more important to focus on than the other, which it naturally happens, but I think it's important that we take a step back.
Yeah, because when you get down to it, rough and tumble play is sensory play.
Right.
And pretending that you're Batman or Wonder Woman or a Ninja Turtle or a Jedi is sensory play. And there are way too many programs out there that are banning, curtailing, over controlling those types of play, and slowing down the development of the proprioceptive and vestibular activities, because the way you know how to gently grab your pencil or pen when you're learning to write your name is to have lots of practice grabbing stuff, including that kid you're wrestling with, and learning how much pressure to use and those kind of things, and what position your body is in, and how being able to stay upright in your chair. And so we're rushing all that academic stuff before we finish the wiring. And it's kind of trying to, it's like moving into a house and trying to plug in your refrigerator and your computer and your washing machine before the builders have finished wiring the house for electricity. And when it's setting kids up to fail.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's a great analogy, Jeff, because I was taking some kids on a hike this morning, ages between 4 and like 7.5. And so it's all still, you know, early childhood. And it was so amazing to see them go out and, you know, they all come from classrooms. They all go to like typical schools. It's so amazing to see them come out and like just use their whole bodies. And there, it was really muddy out today, and their rain boots were sinking in the mud. And so they really had to, A, watch where they were going, and B, if they got stuck in the mud, they had to figure out like how were they going to get out, right? Like, were they going to just try to pull their foot out? Were they going to take their foot out of their boot and then pull the boot out? And like, how is that going to work? And working with each other to help each other get in and out of the mud, there was all of this exchange of energy. And I was like, because we were recording this for this topic today, I was kind of had like an eye out for it. And I was looking at all of their joints, right? And on all of this movement that they were doing with each other, and we were on these like steep hills that we were hiking, and they're having to figure out how to manage their bodies on this slope. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I was thinking of that, like, wow, they're still figuring all of this stuff out, because some of them are falling, they're like, I need help, they're struggling a little bit, but it was just enough of struggle that I was really seeing a lot of growth. And I was like, wow, like, I wonder, you know, in the classroom, in their everyday classroom, like, if their teacher might be like, oh, they're lacking in this or that, or something related to being able to hold the pencil or sit in the chair or whatever, they might mark on that report card, right? Like, this kid needs to work on this. And then I'm watching them out on this hike doing all this amazing stuff, and I'm like, but what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing to provide the encouragement for that development, aside from putting a pencil in their hand? There are other ways to encourage these skills without just forcing that thing that they're not quite ready for. Right.
Well, like, I mean, you could sit down and you could sit down in circle time for 20 minutes and go through a lesson about how to properly hold a pencil. I mean, you could do that. There's got to be a worksheet for proper pencil holding. You could go online and buy one of those little special grippy things you can put on your pencil, or the special shaped pencils. Or you could just let the kids play. I mean, those are all choices that people in this profession are making, and it it bothers me to no end that so many of them keep making the wrong choices. Am I being judgy? Fuck yes, I'm being judgy. Because somebody needs to be, because if we're not judgy about this kind of stuff, then all that bad practice bullshit keeps happening. And there's just way too much of it. And I mean, how do we fix that? I mean, the three of us yapping on this podcast truthfully isn't going to do a lot, because we're mostly speaking to the converted or the people who at least put themselves in the play pew.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, because I'm opening my program this year, and something that for me it's a strength of mine that I've learned is a strength of mine that I'm kind of using to get more information out there, is I really find it valuable to work with parents that once they trust you, like once a parent trusts me and they feel like, wow, my child is just really thriving in Rebecca's care, then they want to hear what I have to say more, right? So if I talk to them about play-based learning, or I talk to them about what to look for when you are enrolling your child in school, you know, if some people don't, you know, have more options than others, but it's really amazing to talk to parents, and then you almost like take pressure off of their shoulders.
Yeah.
Because like, you're right. Like, I see my child learning at home all the time. I don't have to set up a breakfast invitation for them to do some sorting activity before breakfast. You know, like they feel more at ease, I think, once they hear from you as like an educator that, you know what, you're doing enough as long as you're letting your child play. And so many parents feel pressured to like do so much for their kids. So that's something that I'm leaning on, is just talking with parents and building that relationship and getting the word out there with families.
So this is actually something that hits a nerve for me, because when we were getting my son screened for kindergarten, and I only say this because I've noticed now, like as the pre-K teacher that sees a lot of kids getting screened for kindergarten, he was marked low, and I mean really low on his fine motor development. And it was frustrating because it's like I've never forced him to like sit down. And I mean, even today, it's like his handwriting is horrible, is what all of his teachers say. But he plays with Play-Doh and he paints. I'm not going to sit down and make him practice letters. I'm not going to. And that's what, you know, he loves to use his scissors. He's great at cutting with scissors, but we're so focused on the academic of how the look is. And it's frustrating because parents get so scared. I don't know a better word for it, of like, there's something wrong with my child, and there's nothing wrong with your child. They're developing at the level that they need to develop at. And so let them have that sensory play, get out that Play-Doh, get out that slime, get out those scissors, but don't feel that because they were marked low for just their fine motor development, that there is something wrong with your child. Every child develops at a different level. And I feel like, in screenings, that gets taken out. It's just like, oh, you're not at the average level, so you're delayed. And that to me was, it cognitively, he's incredibly intelligent. So I don't care that it looks like chicken scratch. Can you read it? Cool.
I think so. Yeah, it's important that parents feel that support from us as teachers, because, you know, I can't fix the school system, just me as one person, right?
Right.
But I also don't want to be that person who's like, oh, I can't do it. Like, too big of a problem, so I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to, you know, live in my own little world and not really care. And so I think I try to like balance that of, you know, I can't fix everything, but who can I impact? And I think it's important that families know that play-based learning is not just okay, but it's ideal.
Right.
Especially for young children, and for, I think, society to change in general, we have to continue educating families. because they're going to be the ones who are enrolling their kids in these programs, right? And so if you have more and more and more families looking for play-based programs, you know, it's that basic economics of supply and demand, right? Why are there more forest schools than ever before in the United States? Because of COVID and because of the vast number of people getting outside more than was before. And so when there's a demand, then that supply will come. And I think that it's easy to feel like nothing's happening because our lives are so short. But I just think even in the last 10 years, at least here in my area, I hear a lot more from families about like wanting play-based learning and child-led education, which I was not hearing nearly as much, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so it's a slow progress and it feels almost really daunting sometimes, but yeah, I think parents and families is the one of the best ways that we can go about it.
Well,
I think it's more impactful than writing a letter to my senator, to be perfectly honest.
This episode brought to you by Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. What, Rachel?
I'm just the thing is I feel like we're all educated to know, like we've been whether trainings or going to school in early childhood to understand the importance of sensory play. But it's like you said, that's not information that like parents know to go out and search for, you know, it's just like that leaves it up to the teachers. We're the ones who have that information. And that's just an important role as the early childhood caregiver to share that information. If you have a parent that's like, well, why aren't, I get asked this all the time. Why don't you make them practice their name? Why aren't you sitting down making them practice their name? Do you want to do something that you're forced to do? Or do you want to do something like create with Play-Doh? You know, children are more apt to engage in those sensory experiences than sit down and do worksheets. It's not developmentally appropriate.
Yeah.
And then being able to add to that he's not sitting down practicing writing his name because he doesn't care about that right now. And he's doing something that's getting him ready for that. See how he's over there rough and tumbling with his friends. All of that grabbing and grappling put together. That grappling, I've just invented a new word. I got to write that down. Grabbling. Okay, somebody go put that on Urban Dictionary. Jeff Johnson invented the word grabbling today. So they're over there on the rough and tumble area grabbling, and he's see how he's flipping and spinning? That's building his vestibular sense, his sense of balance. And before he can go to kindergarten and first grade and sit upright in his chair for long periods of time, that sense of balance needs to be developed because he's spending a whole lot of his brain energy on just staying upright now. And as that system wires, he'll be able to do it. It'll happen more automatically when he gets a little bit older and as he has more practice. He's also gripping his, see how he's grabbing his buddy and trying to drag him to the ground? That's building that proprioceptive sense. And it works. Our body works from big to small. So he's learning how much pressure to apply with those arms, and he's building his shoulders and his upper arms and his wrists so that he'll finally be able to develop those fine motor muscle, that fine muscle control in his hands and wrists, which will allow him to write his name when he's interested. And so making that connection between the rough and tumble and the heavy work and all of the other stuff kids are engaged in, wiring those sensory systems, and helping parents understand that there's that direct line between those activities and the academic stuff we want them to get to eventually.
Yeah, I have a question, Rachel. How do you guys do like family communication aside from like brief conversation at drop off and pick up?
So we actually use an app. And so constantly I'm sending pictures and videos throughout the day to parents. So they have that. And a lot of the parents, because we're a small town and local, we bump into each other. So there's just the brief, they know how you can find, it's a little bitty town, you can find us.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I kind of get, I don't want to say like, I don't get in trouble, but teased, I guess, kind of about, is because like when we have parent teacher conferences and sit down with the parents, and I'll have those parents who are like, you know, ABC what's going on. And I do have in-depth conversations, and it's like, you've got to shorten that, is what I get told. You've got to shorten that. And I'm like, no, this is valuable information. Not only is it valuable information, but, you know, parents want to know these things. They want to know these connections. And I usually, like, I have a nice list of resources for different things. And I'm like, if you're really looking for something, you really want to know something more, here's the resource I got this from.
That's fantastic.
That you can also take. So that's how I like to, I don't know. That's just me. I feel like it should be a really personal connection. I'm taking care of the most precious thing in the world, you know,
right.
Your small child. And I respect that. I respect that you trust me enough to do that. And so I can take 15 minutes to have a conversation with you about your concerns.
Yeah. I ask because I think that it's hard in drop off and pick up, right? Because we're caring for children still. And so we can't have those in-depth conversations during that time. Even sometimes like parents want to, or it starts happening, but you're like, oh, I got to go, you know, I'm watching the kids. And so I think like parent-teacher conferences, that's a great time to really delve into those topics. Like if a parent has that concern, right? Like, you know, they're starting kindergarten next year and he's still writing his name backwards, you know, is that okay? And then you can have that conversation about all of the learning that you're seeing this child doing in the sensory table, in the sandbox, on the playground, where you're seeing this child maybe manipulating shapes, where you're seeing them doing all of these things that are related to writing. And you can talk about that. And the app is a good way too. I mean, you can't get too in depth, but right. Like, you know, if you send a picture, you could put those little captions, like, maybe even have some like to pull out of your pocket for certain topics of you know, flipping the spatula in the house area is wrist movement, right? And that's going to help build that strength.
So I'm a little like particular in the sense that, like, yes, I send the picture in the app, but I also have our administrator print off the picture. And I'll write down the observation of what they were doing on the back of the picture. So when we have parent-teacher conferences, a skill that I see that they've mastered, or if I know that there's a concern that the parent had, I'm like, here, you see this picture right here. This is what, like, it helps my memory to have that visual for them. And right. Like, okay, here's ABC. Your concern was this. And look at him right here or her doing this right now. That's I keep a folder at all times, and I literally wear an apron with sticky notes inside of it. So I can just like write down like today, da, 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 this happened, and it's in their folder and we go back and talk to it. But that's just something I've learned over the years to fine tune observations, to search for these things, you know?
Is this just around the waist apron, or is this around the neck? How many aprons are there?
I have two. Uh-huh. Because they had to be fashionable, mm-hmm. to a degree, but they're full body. So they're full body and they crisscross super easy on and off. It's just, I found that every time I decided to wear a light color, lunch that day was like spaghetti. And I got tired of that stuff getting, like, that's really what started it. But then I was like, oh, it's nifty because it has pockets and I have Kleenexes and pens and post-it notes, you know, that's
sure.
It. Yeah. And so I ended up with two, and I let my co-teacher wear them too. They're universal. So
years ago, my daughter made some for Lisa Murphy that she'd wear. I think one was like with Skoll's fabric and stuff that she'd use in she'd wear in her presentations when she was doing her messy presentation. So I think, you know, I like to wear an apron around the house. You know, but that's just mostly because I like to feel pretty. It's a 1950s kind of frilly thing, but that's a little bit off topic. And maybe I should have, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe I should have kept that to myself. But no, my other question was, what color stickies? Do you have different colors for different things?
As of right now, I probably started this like 3 or 4 months ago. So as of right now, they're just yellow. Just until, like, I'm still fine tuning the observation method.
Yeah.
But I did want to bring up something else. Like we were talking, it's not just fine motor development. I know that the last time that we talked, I was telling you guys how I had big energy and we were doing the wrestling. So literally the next day I went back and I told my kids, like, I'm going to let you guys wrestle. But here's the gig. There's no hitting each other upside the head. There's no purposely kicking anybody, and there's no sitting on anyone's head. And the main thing is, if somebody tells you to get off, that's time to get off. You know, like those are our stipulations. Otherwise, free for all, have fun with it on the mats is where we're doing it. And the observation that I noticed is my kids' emotional states are so much better. It's just, I'm having less fits. My personal stress level is so much lower because I feel like I'm putting out less fires with the kiddos, and it's giving me more time to engage with them. And honestly, a surprising observation is that the girls in my class prefer it. It started out with the boys, and I have two girls that like slam each other down and giggle the whole time. I mean, it's wonderful, but I was surprised by that because they're these petite little quiet little ones, you know, and we go in here and it's like WWE, and I'm like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. But the emotional state that I'm seeing from just giving them those big body movements from in that freedom, I mean, it's really,
yeah, it's our nervous system, right? Like, we forget that all of it's also connected, that our bodies and our nervous system is connected to our emotions and our self-regulation. And for some reason we compartmentalize everything and we forget how connected everything is, right? Like our energy getting out, and then the joy, like you said, the kids are giggling, they're building these bonds and these relationships. It makes it a lot easier to, like, when you're done wrestling, like, let's go to the house area and we'll go, you know, cook everybody some sandwiches, and then we'll go do this and that, because you've already had that bonding time. Right. And so it all is so cyclical of that good energy and that development of the friendship, your body, your nervous system being able to regulate itself and calm down.
But also teaching them boundaries and respect without even realizing it. You know what I mean?
No one wants to get hurt, you know? No,
and so, they have done really, really well. I think the first day, it was like a pile of like five kids on top of one, and you just hear a muffled, "Get off me!" But, and I'm like, okay, guys, come on, let's, you know, respect too many bodies. But
yeah, take a little practice for sure.
Yeah, but it's made me so happy. And yeah, the other teachers that were in there kind of like, and I said, I'm letting your kids do it. I can't let my kids do it and not let your kids do it. But just, can we just sit back and watch? Can we just watch and enjoy? And because I don't feel like during the day, most of the time you're like, oh, I've got to engage, I got to do this, I got to do this. But can we sit back and enjoy our kids just being kids?
And yes,
that's what I'm loving about. I really wanted to update you guys about that because it's such a big thing to me.
So how much of that have you done before?
Wrestling was always taboo before. And then you have the stipulations on allowing superhero play of, you know, that's encouraging such bad stuff. And so it's not that I haven't wanted to, it's the fear of getting in trouble somehow, kind of, you know, and the fear of like upsetting parents. But let me be honest with you, the day I started allowing this wrestling, I stayed late and met with every parent in my classroom. And I said, hey, I know you guys are tired of the talks of like your child's done ABC and it's these big body movements. I said, so I'm letting them wrestle, but I told them the boundaries that we had implied. And I also said, I just want to make you aware they're choosing to do this. If they come home with a bruise and we're on, like, I wasn't aware of it, because I'm sure that will happen in wrestling. This is why. And they were all like, oh, they wrestle at home, they do that with mom or dad. And that was what was another kind of shocker, is parents are okay with it. If you have a conversation with them, they're okay with it. So that,
and they, I trust, mean, you. They trust you. I think that's the thing, is you have to start there, right?
Yes. And but and all the engagement of this big big sensory play, the importance of the conversation. Take the time to have the conversation with your parents is what I feel is the most important thing. It takes you, it gets you so much further. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so how we often see parents as a barrier when really it's they're on
they
the same
want to work with you.
Yeah.
How are the other adults in your program responding to it?
So I only really see like the other, there's pre-K one and pre-K two in my program. So I only really see pre-K two and they're okay with it. They're still a little bit leery when it gets, when people are getting hurt. But the thing is like, if a child gets hurt, we sit down and we talk about it, you know, like,
Okay,
you did not like that. This was your choice. You can go back to the mat and play. We can go get a drink or we can talk to your friend about why it hurt. So that's another thing. You're teaching them about the body input that they're putting into their friends, you know, like that was too hard of a shove for him. Mm-hmm. And then they know like, well, I'm not going to shove him this hard, but it's all learning.
Yeah.
It's all learning.
Yeah. They learn about each other's boundaries too. It's just like, I think I always try to go back into like the history of humans, you know, children have grown up in mixed ages and they had to learn, okay, we can't push the toddler like we push the 8-year-old, you know, when we are going to go slide down this grassy hill, we know that this little one has to go with someone else. Like, I think it's so natural for kids to learn these things and learn like, okay, this person likes it this way, this person likes it that way, but they'll never learn it if we always say no, 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 no. And so right. It's really beautiful to see them being able to differentiate, right? We sometimes sell kids so short, like they won't be able to figure that out. And it's like, they so can't.
Yeah.
Well, just learning that you can get quote unquote hurt. Because a lot of times it's, I mean, you haven't, I'm guessing there hasn't been a bone sticking out. Mm-mm. Yet.
No.
Yeah. So most of the hurts are pretty minor, but learning that you can survive that is a really big part of learning too. I think it's, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, personally go around injuring toddlers and preschoolers on purpose. But
right.
I think it's, I mean, I think skinned knees and bumps and bruises and those kind of things are part of the process of growing and developing as a human and learning to navigate the physical and emotional side of those things is vital. Because, man, if you get to be 8 years old and you've never scraped your knee, I would really worry about your ability to be out in the world, right? Or am I just a dick?
No, I feel like I have these same fears about kids these days not having experiences, just being outside and playing free play. I have so many fears about them. I mean, we're seeing the evidence of it now. Youth they're struggling mentally and emotionally.
There's a heightened level, I feel like, of anxiety, and it's because we've put that fear, be scared to get the bruise. Be scared to get the skin knee. You know, twice this week I've gotten phone calls because my son came home with a black eye and a busted lip. And because he ran into somebody, he's not fighting, but like in the course of his play, he's crashed and burned. And the nurse almost sounded relieved because I was like, honestly, I'm just waiting for the stitches. I'm not mad. Like, he's going to yeah. do it. It is what it is. But I'm just waiting for the day I have to leave and go take him to get stitches.
I thought he was like in a bar fight or something.
Right. Well, yeah, he doesn't even care. He's like, yeah, yeah. And jumping up and down and telling me what happened, like in snippets, I got hurt. It's fine. Bye. And he's, mm-hmm. you know, off to the next thing. We dwell so much on the injury more so than I feel like the child does. And we're teaching children to dwell on those injuries instead of learning and moving on, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. It's so many factors. It's the lack of opportunity to even get injured, right? When kids yeah. are sitting on a couch for all these hours. And then when we do put them in precarious situations, it's like that helicopter feeling, like, don't climb on that ledge. You know, you could fall. It's like, yeah, you could. This is how you learn how to be mindful, right, and be in the moment, and the motor planning and all of that. I remember being a kid and just when going out and exploring a new town, a new place, I would go as far from my parents as possible. They were like, as long as I can see you, you know, and I'd be walking along the ledges of the properties and jumping from things and climbing trees, just like going to about my day to day. You know, I wasn't on some hike or anything, but like we would just be out doing things, and I would move my body around so much. And I cherish that I had all of those experiences, because so few kids do nowadays. You know, like today I was driving around, and Saturday afternoon, the weather is nice here. It's like in the 60s, fantastic weather. There is not a single kid playing outside. Not one. As I'm driving around. Yeah, not one. I'm like, they're all
driving around looking for young children. That sounds sounds a little bit creepy.
I drove from where I took the kids on a hike is in a, like, the parks in the East Bay are really big. And so there's a lot of entrances, and there's like random little pockets that you can enter the park through different neighborhoods. And so I had to drive through a really big neighborhood in Danville, California this morning. And then I dropped something off to my mom, and then I pulled up, because I was like, I have to go record a podcast. So I pulled up this hill. This is actually a neighborhood I used to live in. And yeah, I mean, I've been sitting here for a little over an hour, and not a single kid in sight. And this is where I grew up. So
hey, really hey, cool. Listeners, from what we can see, Rebecca is in a panel van without any windows. So I don't know. It looks like
you have
to
be Rebecca.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's got a bunch of, she's got like rolls of duct tape on the center console there. That's weird. We'll have to follow up on that. It's about time to wrap this one up. Rachel, I got a challenge for you.
Okay.
For your rough and tumble play. How much after, you know, maybe give them another week or something. And then sit down with them and go over the rules that you've set up and give them a little bit more power and control over what those rules are going to be. Because part of that process, once kids have experience with that kind of play, is making the rules. And we touched on earlier that, you know, we don't, as humans, we don't want to get hurt. And so my experience is, and I think Mike Huber talks about this in his book, Embracing Rough and Tumble Play. Kids, when they get to be involved in that rulemaking, they quickly come up with rules like, hey, we're not going to punch in the face. Because you know what? It hurts to get punched in the face. Right. And so when kids have power and control over that, you're adding to that play, you're adding the opportunity for language development, you're adding the opportunity for problem solving, for cooperative learning, those kind of things. And so now that you've given them a taste of that, give them some more control over it if you're feeling they're ready for it, because that allows you to even step back more, because then you don't have to be the rule keeper, because when they start creating the rules, they start managing that side of it too.
Right. Theoretically. Nope, challenge accepted. I'm down.
You know what I did in my pre-K classroom? I mentioned to you last time we talked about this that I had a really small classroom, and we had these mats that we pulled down from the shelf. And when we pulled down the mats, we had like a whiteboard with the rules. And mm-hmm. So like, for the most part, they stayed the same, but like they would change over time, depending on the kids who were there or the time of year. And yeah, it was a little whiteboard that we kept, and we would read it together. And it honestly helped a lot of the kids with their reading and writing skills. Kids that weren't into the writing art areas. They were at the wrestling mats, writing things down on the rule board and making lists and things like that. So that was really fun. And it was easy to pull in and out.
Yeah, because in early learning, it's all the learning all of the time. It's not compartmentalized like we adults like to make it. They're learning language, they're learning social skills, they're learning physical skills. It's all happening at the same time, all the time with young children. Our job is just to kind of help keep everybody healthy and safe while they're doing it. Any final thoughts before we pull the plug on this one?
If you are curious about wrestling or rough and tumble play. Just try it for 1 week and see how it goes. That's just my challenge to you if you're on the fence. Try it for one full week.
And email Rachel if you have any questions.
I'll have suggestions.
Hey, listeners, I'm going to throw this out there. There's a link in the show notes. After some listener calls and some talks to people that I do trainings for, there seems to be a desire for a early learning community of practice someplace. So I'm thinking about building one on the Explorations Early Learning website where people can get together and they can talk about dead turtles and rough and tumble play and all that kind of stuff. If you're interested in being part of something like that, fill out the form in the show notes and send it my way, and I'll keep you updated on our progress. But I've heard from enough people already that it looks like it's something I'm going to commit some time and energy and resources to and give it a go and see what happens. Next, we're going to come back next time the three of us are together. Next time we've got an R&R version of the Child Care Bar and Grill. We're going to talk, I think we're going to talk tag, and I got some thoughts on daiquiris. So stay tuned for that. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. Back soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production. Oh.